Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now going to begin a study of the book of Micah, starting in chapter 1, which I will entitle The Coming Destruction on All Israel. We begin now in Micah 1:1. The word of the Lord which came to Micah of Moresheth in the days of Jotham, who ruled from 740 to 732, Ahaz, who ruled from 732 to 716, and Hezekiah, who ruled between 716 and 687 B.C., kings of Judah, which Micah saw concerning Samaria and Jerusalem. Now, this Micah of Moresheth, nothing is known of his life, not much. His father is not mentioned, from which some people deduce that he was of the common people, especially since he preached against the privileged classes. That's an inference. It may or may not be true. I can imagine a privileged person preaching against his fellow privileged people. But maybe so. Maybe Micah is a common man. He was a contemporary of Isaiah, Hosea, and Amos because, although we don't know much about him, at least we have his dates. Because we know the dates of Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, the kings of Judah. Now Jeremiah, who started prophesying in 626, in the century after this, he quotes Micah. Jeremiah 26:18, Jeremiah says this, Micah the Moreshite prophesied in the days of Hezekiah, king of Judah, and said to all the people of Judah, this is what the Lord of hosts says, Zion will be plowed like a field, Jerusalem will become ruins, and the Temple Mount a forested hill. So Jeremiah takes Micah's prophecy to refer to the destruction of Jerusalem, because that's what Jeremiah was talking about, the destruction of Jerusalem in 586 B.C. when the Babylonians came. Now that quotation of Micah by Jeremiah was taken from Micah 3:12. I'll read it now. Therefore, because of you, Zion will be plowed like a field. Jerusalem will become ruins, and the hill of the Temple Mount will be a thicket. Almost a direct quote, a direct quote. Now we see from that quote that Micah is not only prophesying against the northern kingdom. At the end of verse 1, Micah says that his word concerned Samaria and Jerusalem. Samaria, of course, is the capital of the northern 10 tribes, northern Israel. Samaria was the capital city located in the large northern Israelite tribe of Ephraim and Jerusalem. So Jerusalem's included, and Jeremiah included Micah in a denunciation of Jerusalem. So that gives us some context. Micah is prophesying against all of Israel, not just the north and not just the south. Barnes says that Micah's full name was Micaiah, which means who is like the Lord, and Micah was probably called the short form Micah to distinguish him from his great predecessor Micaiah, son of Imlah. Micaiah, son of Imlah, prophesied in the reign of Ahab, who ruled from 874 to 853. Now, Micah is said to come from Moresheth. The town of Moresheth, which is also called Moresheth-Gath, is thought to be a few miles east of Gath. A commentator named Ted Wade says that Moresheth-Gath was 21 miles southwest of Jerusalem in the Low Country, heading toward the Shephelah, heading toward Philistine country, as you head toward the Mediterranean Sea, that large area of plain. And so Moresheth was on the border of Judah and Philistia. So Micah was a man from the country coming to the big city to preach the word of God. Now, how can we assume that Micah prophesied in Jerusalem? Well, I suppose it's because most of his prophecies were against Jerusalem, and if they're going to hear what's going to happen to him, he would have to be there to make the prophecy. Now, verse 1 says that Micah ministered as a prophet in the times of those three kings that I mentioned. So his earliest possible date would be 740 B.C., the start of the reign of Jotham, and his latest possible date is 687 B.C., the end of the reign of Hezekiah. So his dates are fairly well tied down. We could narrow the dates down a little bit more. I don't really think it's necessary, but we can say he probably prophesied before the important reforms of Hezekiah. Hezekiah was a noted reformer, and Micah is preaching against an unreformed situation. But again, I don't think it's that necessary. Now, going from 740 to 687, that's a long period of time to have just this small number of prophecies that we're going to have in the book of Micah. And so from that, one commentator has speculated that Micah probably spent most of his time orally preaching and exhorting the people. Now, in verse 1, Micah says, this word which he saw. He saw a word. That's interesting. None of my commentators that I saw made a comment about that, but seeing a word to me kind of strikes me as strange. It must have been a vision is the only way I can understand that. Now, I said that Micah prophesied against both Samaria and Jerusalem. Most of his prophecies were against Jerusalem, although he included Samaria in the collection. So we go now to Micah 1, verses 2 through 5. Micah continues, "Hear, O peoples, all of you, listen, O earth and all it contains, and let the Lord God be a witness against you, the Lord from his holy temple. For behold, the Lord is coming forth from his place. He will come down and tread on the high places of the earth. The mountains will melt under him, and the valleys will be split, like wax before the fire, like water poured down a steep place. All this is for the rebellion of Jacob and for the sins of the house of Israel. What is the rebellion of Jacob? Is it not Samaria? What is the high place of Judah? Is it not Jerusalem?" Now in verse 2, Micah says, "Hear, O peoples, all of you, listen, O earth." Now that could be all the peoples of the earth that Micah is prophesying to, but that Eretz there, O earth, could be translated as land, and so you could read it this way, "Hear, O peoples, all of you, listen, O land, and all it contains." That would refer to all the tribes of Israel that Micah would be prophesying to. And that makes more sense to me, because why would the people of the earth care about what happens to Israel? It's directly relevant, this prophecy is, to Israel. However, I looked at all my translations, and all of them had earth and not land. Well, I guess that means I'm all alone on that, or maybe there's something I don't see. And so Micah says, "Let the Lord God be a witness against you, the Lord from his holy temple." Now, God's temple, there's always a question, is that his temple in heaven, or is he talking about his temple on Zion, Mount Zion in Jerusalem? Gill and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say it's his temple in heaven. Barnes mentions the temple in Jerusalem as an option only. I tend to think it's heaven. Micah says in verse 3, "Behold, the Lord is coming forth from his place." His place, of course, is heaven. He's coming forth to whack Samaria and Jerusalem. Now, there you've got God coming. That's a spiritual coming. And it reminds me, since I just taught on the Olivet Discourse yesterday at church, and people had a little problem seeing Jesus is coming. "Lord, what will be the sign of your coming?" Oh, that has to be the second physical coming at the end of time. No, it does not. Here you have a spiritual coming forth. Now, it's not the same Greek word in the Septuagint translation, parousia, as Jesus used, but it's still the same idea, a coming in judgment, just like Jesus came in judgment to judge Jerusalem at the Mount of Olives. Now, Yahweh comes in verse 3, to tread on the high places of the earth. Now, the high places of the earth would be mountains, towers, fortified places, but especially idol shrines, because that's where people put idol shrines. They wanted the idols to be close to the gods up in the sky, and so they would traditionally put idols on hills. But God's going to come and tread on those idols. He's going to walk on the high places of the earth. Now, of course, all this is anthropomorphic language. God doesn't have feet. I really don't even think it's necessary to mention that. Verse 4, "The mountains will melt under him." Now, here we have typical decreation, change of regime, judgment rhetoric that prophets always used when a nation was going down in the face of judgment from God. When you see rhetoric like the moon will turn red, the sun will turn black at noon, stars will fall from the sky like figs from a tree, the skies will roll up like a tent, the earth will quake, the mountains will melt, the valleys will be split. That's just how the prophets wanted to tell you that there's judgment coming on a nation. It is not meant to be taken literally. All of you eschatology nuts out there who read Hal Lindsey and Tim LaHaye get all hot and bothered, it's not meant to be taken literally. After all, Joel said the moon will turn red, not Joel, but Peter quoting Joel, at Pentecost, and the moon didn't turn red at Pentecost. But Samaria and Jerusalem will be like a mountain that's melting, a valley that's split open, like wax that melts before the fire. Wax doesn't last very long before a fire. Water poured down a steep place. Think of a waterfall. Great metaphors. You're going down, Jerusalem and Samaria. Verse 5, "All this is for the rebellion of Jacob." Jacob, of course, is the name given to the northern 10 tribes, because Jacob is also another name for Israel. And that's what the northern 10 tribes were called, Israel. Jacob, the twin brother of Esau, His original name was Israel because he wrestled with God at Peniel on the Jabbok River. And then when he deceived Esau, he got his name changed to Jacob, which means deceiver. So this is the northern kingdom that Micah is preaching against here. And all this destruction, the mountains melting like wax, etc., is because of the sins of the house of Israel. Of course, that's why they're going down, because they sinned. What is the rebellion of Jacob? Is it not Samaria? In other words, Samaria, the capital city of northern Israel, epitomizes all the rebellion of the northern kingdom. It's concentrated there. What is the high place of Judah? Is it not Jerusalem? Well, actually, Jerusalem was a high place. It's very high. I remember riding on a bus coming from the Jordan River going up to Jerusalem. I thought the bus wasn't going to make it. It was so steep. It was striking to me. But not only was Jerusalem high geographically, it had become a high place of idolatry. Mount Zion on Jerusalem was a place for the temple of God, a high place for the worship of Yahweh, and it had become a high place for the worship of idols. And God's going to come stomp on all that. We go down to Micah chapter 1, verses 6 through 9. Therefore, I will make Samaria a heap of ruins in the countryside, a planting area for a vineyard. I will roll her stones into the valley and expose her foundations. All her carved images will be smashed to pieces. All her wages will be burned in the fire, and I will destroy all her idols. Since she collected the wages of a prostitute, they will be used again for a prostitute. Because of this, I will lament and wail. Now the I here switches from Yahweh to Micah himself. Verse 8, because of this, I will lament and wail. I will walk barefoot and naked. I will howl like the jackals and mourn like ostriches. For her wound is incurable and has reached even Judah. It has approached the gate of my people as far as Jerusalem. Now that switch in verse 6 to verse 8, the switch from Yahweh to Micah speaking, I, the first person pronoun, referent, seems like a sudden switch to me. None of my commentators made any remark about that, but it seems remarkable to me. I also checked the translations. The translations all say the same, so I don't know, but obviously it's not Micah making Samaria a heap of ruins, and it's not Yahweh lamenting and wailing and walking barefoot and naked. So the context makes it clear what's meant here. Now, Yahweh says he's going to make Samaria a heap of ruins. The God's Word translation says he's going to make Samaria a pile of rubble. Now, when did that happen? Well, Guzik, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brandon Poole say it's in 722 BC when Shalmaneser V invaded and conquered Samaria, took it after a three-year siege, and I think that's what Mike is referring to. John Gill gives another option. He says John Hyrcanus, the Maccabean, who ruled Jerusalem and Judah, from 135/134 to 104, John Hyrcanus leveled Samaria to the ground even more than Shalmaneser V did. Shalmaneser V didn't do that. He just took the city and took the people into exile, what Hyrcanus did. I don't think so, because I always like to fulfill prophecies historically in a time that's fairly close to the prophet, because he's preaching to people who are going to experience what he's prophesying, at least shortly. You put it 400 or 500 years in advance, like at the time of John Hyrcanus, and it doesn't quite have the same impact. Now, if Samaria is made a planting area for a vineyard, in other words, there's no more city there, it's countryside because it's wiped out, I will roll her stones into the valley. If I remember correctly, Samaria was on a hill. I can't tell you where I read that. That's just my memory. I might be wrong, but I'm pretty sure Samaria was up on a hill. And so it would be appropriate to see its stones rolled into a valley. Her foundations would be exposed. Well, if you compare Samaria to a building and you think about a building, if the foundations are exposed to where the public can see the foundations, that building has been torn down and destroyed. All her carved images in verse 7 will be smashed to pieces. All her wages will be burned in the fire. Now, what does that mean? Since she collected the wages of a prostitute, what are the wages of a prostitute that were burned in a fire? Well, there's two options. The easiest option is from Poole. He says that people pay money to spiritually whore around with Samaria. So Samaria makes money as a prostitute, a spiritual prostitute, if you will, because of all her idols there. And then Samaria will have to take the money she earned by being a spiritual whore, and then she'll have to go pay Assyria to whore around with Assyrian idols, spiritually whore around with Assyria. And that's the easiest way to take it. The pulpit commentator says that the wages of a prostitute are the images and idols themselves that people brought into Samaria, or perhaps images and idols which were paid for by offerings made to the idols in Samaria, and Samaria brought more images and idols and then sent those same images and idols to Assyria when Assyria captured them. I think that's a stretch. I'll just take it as money that was paid to the Samaritans for their idol services. But verse 7 says, Micah says, all of Samaria's wages will be burned in the fire, all that money she made, and I will destroy all her idols. Since she collected the wages of a prostitute, they will be used again for a prostitute. In other words, the money that she made, she's going to have to pay to whore around with Assyria. Now we have a problem here. How can wages that are burned up in the fire, as verse 7 says, how can they be used again? They're burned up in the fire. Well, my solution to this, and none of my commentators that I saw really address this problem, is that the gold and silver being used to pay to the idols in Samaria, the Assyrians took that gold and silver and melted it down and carried it off to Assyria. Thus, the Samaritans could be said to be paying wages of a prostitute to the Assyrians, because they're going to commit spiritual prostitution with the Assyrians. They're going to end up worshiping their gods. Verse 8, because of this, I, that's Micah now, will lament and wail. He's sad now because he's not only sad, he's really anguished, grief-stricken, because the judgment of Samaria, the northern kingdom, is heading to his country and capital. And we know that the Assyrians also came down to harass Judah in the times of Hezekiah around 701. Sennacherib came down, took a bunch of cities down there in the Shephelah as he came up to Jerusalem, and finally Hezekiah held him off. But also after that, in 586, over a century later, the Babylonians came in and flattened Jerusalem. And so I don't know what Micah is seeing here, but he sees judgment and destruction, and he's anguished because of it. I mean, he says, I will walk barefoot and naked. That's a typical sign of mourning. And then he says, I will howl like the jackals. I hear coyotes howling outside of my country house all the time, and it is an awful sound. I assume jackals sound the same way. He will mourn like an ostrich. I don't know how ostriches mourn. Well, because I care so much about you being informed, I stopped my recording and looked it up on the internet. And this is what I found in the Christian Classics Ethereal Library. The voice of the ostrich is very mournful, especially when heard at night in a lonely desert. It is said to be like the crying of a hoarse child. Verse 9, Micah says, her, that's talking about Samaria, her wound is incurable and has reached even Judah. So the destruction of Samaria will also come upon Jerusalem, the capital city of Judah. And again, that could be Sennacherib in 701, or it could be the Babylonians in 586 coming on Judah, but I think it's Sennacherib because it's talking about the Assyrians attacking Samaria and that wound going all the way down to Judah. In other words, it's the Assyrians in both cases. We go down to Micah chapter 1, verses 10 through 12. Don't announce it in Gath. Don't weep at all. Other translations have don't tell it in Gath, which I think is better. But anyway, don't announce it in Gath. Don't weep at all. Roll in the dust in Beth Laophrah. Depart in shameful nakedness, you residents of Shafir. The residents of Zanan will not come out. Beth Ezel is lamenting. Its support is taken from you. Though the residents of Maroth anxiously wait for something good, disaster has come from the Lord to the gate of Jerusalem. Now here we see the start of a list of 9 cities whose names are puns, geographical puns, if you will. We start with the first, Gath, in verse 10. Now, Gath was one of the famous 5 cities of the Philistines. It was about 10 miles north of Lachish. Lachish is due southwest of Jerusalem as you head toward the Mediterranean Sea. A famous place, in fact, Hezekiah saw Sennacherib come down from Assyria and besiege Lachish. It's mentioned a lot in the Bible. And if you go about 10 miles north of Lachish, you get to Gath. Now, what does this mean? Don't tell it in Gath. Don't announce it in Gath. This apparently is taken out of David's lamentation over Saul and Jonathan. As Benson, Poole, and Pulpit all say, if you recall the story, in the last battle of King Saul and his son Jonathan, when they were fighting the Philistines. They got killed by the Philistines at Mount Gabal, got their bodies nailed up on the wall at Beth Shan. Very disastrous defeat of Israel. And so in 2 Samuel 1:20, we read this: "Do not tell it in Gath. Don't announce it in the marketplaces of Ashkelon," one of the other five cities of Babylon, another of the five cities of the Philistines. "Don't announce it, or the daughters of the Philistines will rejoice, and the daughters of the uncircumcised will gloat." Now, that verse is talking about the death of Saul and Jonathan. Micah is referring to that when he says, "Don't tell it in Gath." In other words, don't tell about the disaster that's coming upon Samaria and Jerusalem, because if you do, the enemies of Israel will rejoice. And then he says, "Don't weep at all." Well, if they see you crying, that's going to be pretty embarrassing, isn't it? So hold your tears. Don't let the Philistines know about the approach of the Assyrians. They'll gloat over you if they hear. This is Cambridge and Poole. Confirm that. Now, this expression, "don't tell it to Gath," had become a proverbial saying. Now let's go to the pun. Gath sounds like the Hebrew word for tell. Nagad, Gath, I guess that sounds like it. So this is the first of the 9 puns in Micah 1 that are based on geography. All right, let's look at the second geographical pun. In verse 10, Micah says, "Roll in the dust in Beth La'Ophrah." Beth La'Ophrah means house of dust. Ophrah, the city, is a town that is north of Jerusalem about 10 miles. Goes straight due north. It's in Benjamin, which is the tribe that's north of Jerusalem. Benjamin was a part of Judah. Now, what did mourners do related to dust? Well, they sat in the dust. They covered their heads with dust. They wallowed in the dust. And so when Micah says, "Roll in the dust in Beth La'Ophrah," people knew what he meant. Now, this town was north of Jerusalem. Most of the other towns are to the southwest of Jerusalem in the Shephelah, going down toward Philistine country, all the way down to Gaza, where Hamas is now cutting off babies' heads and raping young women in front of their parents. That same Hamas where people all over the world are cheering them on because they hate Jews, marching in the streets of London, terrorizing Jews on campuses, those modern bastions of tolerance and love and peace. Now, the Shephelah is where Sennacherib attacked Judah when he came into the land and decided to take on Jerusalem. He came from the southwest, from the Shephelah. So this is sensible here that Micah is referring to towns, most of which were in the Shephelah here, because that's where Sennacherib eventually ended up coming. Now, in verse 11, Micah says, "Depart in shameful nakedness, you residents of Shephir." Well, first of all, let's locate Shephir. If you look at the map, Ashkelon, another of the five famous cities of the Philistines, it's on the coast of the Mediterranean at the southwest of Israel. It's right up the coast from Gaza, where the unpleasantness is going on now. I speak in November of 2023. And if you go up from Ashkelon about another 10 miles or so, and then go inland about 2 or 3 miles, you get to Ashdod. All right, taking those two cities, Ashkelon and Ashdod, as the base of a triangle, go eastward, running a line from each of those two cities until they come to a point maybe about 10 miles inland from the Mediterranean Sea is Shephir. That's according to BibleAtlas.org, but there is a question mark there, because nobody has actually found the remains of the place yet. Now, Shephir means beautiful or pleasantness, and this is an ironic pun, kind of a reverse pun, because Micah says, "Depart in shameful nakedness, you residents of that beautiful place, that pleasant place called Shephir." A little bit of irony there. Now, at the end of verse 11, Micah says, "The residents of Zanaan will not come out." Well, BibleAtlas.org has Zanaan as just another name for Shephir in the same place, which they don't know where it is. The word Zanaan means going out, as the NASB note says. BibleAtlas.org says the prophet makes verbal play with the name as if it were derived from Yatzah, to go forth. So the residents of Zanaan, also known as Shephir, they will not come out. Again, it's a negative pun. Zanaan means to go out, but no, they're not going to go out, because they're going to get whacked by the Assyrians. Beth Ezel is lamenting, "Its support is taken away from you," at the end of verse 11. Bethezel, again, is the same place as Shephir and Zanon, right down there in the Shephelah, eastward of Ashdod and Ashkelon. Again, the map has a question mark, so they don't know exactly where it is. Azel, house of Azel. Azel means reserved, side, or near. So BibleAtlas.org translates it as adjoining house. In other words, Bethezel is a house adjoining to Shephir, also known as Zanan. But although Bethezel is adjoining those places, its support is taken from you, Micah says. In other words, it's there for support is what the word means, but no, it's not going to be there. Another reverse pun, if you will. In other words, you didn't support Zanai, and so God's not going to support you because he's not near you. He's not adjoining you anymore. That's the idea. Now we go to our next geographical pun in verse 12. Micah says, though the residents of Maroth anxiously wait for something good, disaster has come from the Lord to the gate of Jerusalem. Maroth, as versenotes.org says, sounds like Hebrew for bitter, which is mara. It means bitterness or rough places. So the residents of Maroth are bitter. They're waiting for something good to happen, and it's not going to happen, because disaster has come to the gate of Jerusalem. Now, where is this Maroth? Well, BibleAtlas.org has it at the same place as Shephir, also known as Zanon, also known as Bethezel. It's a shame people don't know where this place is. It's got four names given to it by Micah. Now, when did this disaster come to the gates of Jerusalem? I am sure that's when Sennacherib came down to the gates of Jerusalem in 701 to harass King Hezekiah, in that famous story. We go now to verse 13 of Micah 1. Micah continues, harness the horses to the chariot, you residents of Lachish. This was the beginning of sin for daughter Zion, because Israel's act of rebellion can be traced to you. Now, as versenotes.org says, Lachish sounds like the Hebrew for team of horses, Rekesh. And so Micah says, harness the horses to the chariot. Another pun. Why would they be doing that? So they could make a hasty escape. Again, as I said earlier, Lachish is about 14 miles northeast of Gaza. I didn't say that earlier. I said it was 21 miles southwest of Jerusalem, about 14 miles northeast of Gaza. So roughly halfway between Gaza and Jerusalem. Gaza, of course, is the famous Philistine city. And of course, that's where all the trouble with Hamas is going on right now. I also mentioned earlier that Lachish was captured by Sennacherib after a long siege. Sennacherib ruled between 705 and 681. That was somewhere around 701 or so. This is a famous story. It's told in 2 Kings 18, Isaiah 36, and Isaiah 37. So Lachish is a well-known place. Now, Lachish here is said to be the beginning of sin for daughter Zion. Daughter Zion, of course, is Jerusalem. Usually, daughter refers to the population of a place, for the population of Zion. I think other translations probably have the daughter of Zion. But at any rate, Lachish is said to be the beginning of sin for Jerusalem, daughter Zion. How did that happen? Let me read you from the pulpit commentator. How Lachish came to adopt the idolatry of Israel and how she infected Judah, we know not. Barnes says, how she, Lachish, came first to apostatize and to be the infectress of Judah. I love that word, infectress of Judah. Scripture does not tell us. She scarcely bordered on Philistia. Jerusalem lay between her and Israel, but the course of sin follows no geographical lines. Well, see, it's kind of interesting that Lachish took Israel's act of rebellion, verse 13. That's northern Israel's acts of rebellion, all the idolatry that was in the northern kingdom, and Lachish introduced it in Jerusalem. Now, how that happened, nobody knows. Geographically, Lachish was not on the border of northern Israel, but nonetheless, she infected Judah with sin and idolatry. We go now to Micah 1, verse 14. Micah continues, therefore, send farewell gifts to Moresheth-Gath. The houses of Achzib are a deception to the kings of Israel. Now, if you will picture Jerusalem under Hezekiah, sending or accepting, I should say, ambassadors from Moresheth-Gath, and when they get there, they say, hey, Moresheth-Gath, won't you help us fight the Assyrians? And then Moresheth-Gath, whether they say yes or no, I don't know, but they leave, and the king of Jerusalem then gives farewell gifts to the ambassadors from Moresheth-Gath. And as I said, that's not recorded anywhere. This is what Micah prophesies. And of course, he might just be being poetic here, as in all these other places. It might not have actually happened. Moresheth Gath, by the way, is Micah's hometown, which I've already talked about in verse 1. Micah 1:1, the word of the Lord that came to Micah the Moreshite. Moreshite means someone from Moresheth, and Moresheth was also called Moresheth Gath. Gath, of course, was one of the five famous cities of the Philistines. It's about 10 miles due north of Lachish, to the west of Jerusalem. Now, let's look at the pun here. Moresheth sounds like the Hebrew for dowry or gift, as versenotes.org says. And so that's why Micah says, send gifts to them. One more pun, another pun. The houses of Achzib are a deception to the kings of Israel. Achzib sounds like the Hebrew for deception, kazav, as versenotes.org says. They say they're going to help. They say they're going to help the kings of Israel, but they don't. Now, they have actually found Achzib. If you'll look at Lachish to the south, 10 miles north is Gath, and then go due east about 10 miles to a point of a triangle, 10 miles on a line from Gath east and 10 miles on a line, 10 miles from Gath on a line to the southeast and 10 miles on a line from Lachish to the northeast, intersecting at a place called Achzib. We go now to Micah 1, verse 15. I will again bring a conqueror against you who live in Marashah. Now, Marashah is about maybe 3 miles to the northeast of Lachish. They have found that place. They know where it is. It's about 6 miles or so to the southeast of Achzib. So we're still in that same area, the Shephelah to the southwest of Jerusalem. Micah says, I will bring again a conqueror against you who live in Marashah. And of course, that conqueror is Assyria. As versenotes.org says, Marashah sounds like Hebrew for conqueror, which is Yarash. Another pun. Now, finally, at the end of verse 15, Micah is going to mention a city that has no pun. The nobility of Israel will come to Adullam. Adullam is about 3 miles to the northeast of Achzib, still in that same area, to the southwest of Jerusalem. David hid from Saul in a cave there, a very famous story in 1 Samuel 22. So the reference to the cave at Adullam is this: the nobility of Israel will come to Adullam. In other words, the glorious kings of Israel will have to flee to caves to get out of the way of the Assyrians. We go down to Micah 1, verse 16, and we'll finish this chapter. Micah says, make yourself bald and cut off your hair because of the children of your delight. Extend your baldness like the eagle, for they will go from you into exile. Now, when you cut your hair off and made yourself bald, that was done when one was mourning his near relatives. We read in Amos 8:10, for example, I will turn your feast into mourning and all your songs into lamentation. I will cause everyone to wear sackcloth and every head to be shaved. Every head to be shaved. That makes your head bald. I will make that grief like mourning for an only son, and its outcome like a bitter day. So Micah is saying, you better start crying, Israel and Judah, because the Assyrians are coming. Cut off your hair, make yourself bald because of the children of your delight. In other words, you're going to lose the children of your delight. Children of a city, of course, is the population. Extend your baldness like the eagle. What does this metaphor mean? Adam Clark says that in casting its feathers and breeding new ones, an eagle is very sickly, its strength wholly exhausted. Well, Adam Clark, who was a polymath and knew everything, including the habits of eagles, I'll take his word for it. I've looked at pictures of eagles that don't have any feathers. They look like buzzards. They look pitiful or pathetic. Or it could be that Micah is just referring to the way that eagles look in general, not just when they're molting and casting off their feathers. After all, we have an American bald eagle, and they all have feathers, but their heads look bald. And I think that's what Micah is referring to. Their heads look bald, and of course, a bald head is a perfect symbol of people in mourning. For they, the children of your delight, will go from you into exile. And of course, that refers to when northern Israel went into exile into Assyria in 722, and later on, Judah went into exile to Babylon in 586. And ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished with this mournful chapter of Micah chapter 1. We are now prepared to go to Micah chapter 2, which I will entitle, Woe to the Oppressors. I hope you stay tuned with me for that discussion, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.